So, Alessandra, over to you. Take it away.
Okay. So thank you very much for this opportunity. It's always nice to talk to a project I care so much about. So thank you, Dan. So, okay, I think we can move to slide two. And in slide two, there's just a little bit of an outline. What I want to do today is a little bit talk about mostly the history of the project and so basically start from the first version of the inflatable antenna, that is the S-band one, and try to give you a complete story there, because that's a development that we started and finished. And then I will spend the second part of this talk looking at what we are currently doing. So what's the extension on the X band? I don't have a lot of test data and material on that, but I know what we are doing. So it's going to be mostly an oral update on where we are with the project at this point. Okay. So if we move on chart three, this is just a little introduction. I think many of you are probably aware. This is basically the time of the CubeSats. There has been basically year by year an increasing number of university company and space agencies that are working on CubeSats. And CubeSat has mostly been used in low Earth orbit. And there's a bunch of now components really for basically almost every subsystem that are available commercially off the shelf. One of the new trends, and that's one of the reasons for which we started the iCubeSat conference before, and then now the Interplanetary Small Satellite Conference, is that besides low Earth orbit, one of the most interesting trends we are seeing in the past 4 or 5 years is a huge interest in the community into trying to develop interplanetary application for these small satellites. And when you go and you think about bringing this technology into a place where it wasn't originally designed for, which is the interplanetary arena, then, there is propulsion problems, there are radiation problems, but there are mostly also a lot of communication problems, because the distance becomes so higher that you have such a strong attenuation that you really need to develop something very different. So JPL is investing a lot into that currently, and there are at least three types of antenna that are being developed. One is deployable, then there are reflector arrays, and then there are inflatables. That is what I'm talking right now. But there is also a lot of work in the radio, in the coding, into multiple access schemes, and also on the ground. So there's a lot of development in trying to ease the transition into the interplanetary space. And in particular, what we are going to talk today is mostly the inflatable. So besides this introduction, if we want to move to chart four, basically what I did, when this project started, I was just approached. At that time, I was at MIT. I was approached by a couple of professors that were interested in seeing whether we could do a mission with a CubeSat to an asteroid. And at that time, there was really, really very little development in antennas for deep space for CubeSats. And my first idea was to make an inflatable antenna. So I knew very little at that point. And the first thing I did was I just Googled it to look basically what has been done in terms of inflatable antenna in space. So if we move on chart five, basically the first thing that comes to mind is, and it comes up on Google when you do search, is what has been done in 1996, which is the antenna that was flown on the STS-77. This is a huge, huge antenna. It's about 28 meters in diameter, I believe. There are three struts, and there is a toroidal ring. So this is I think there are about three inflation systems on this antenna. And so the first thing is we looked at whether we could do something similar to this. So, I mean, basically taking this idea of the struts with the toroidal ring and maybe doing the middle sort of reflector array kind kind of membrane in the middle and try to basically reduce it down to 1 meter diameter and see if we could do something like that for the CubeSat. So if we go yes.
Excuse me, Alessandra, this is Dan. I just want to ask you about this this space shuttle experiment.
Yes.
How is it tested out? That is, what is it pointed at? It doesn't really look like it has much of a pointing system on it. And
it was more a radar than I think it was like, it wasn't a telecom antenna. It was more used as a radar, first of all. And then I think that they had some problem in the inflation. So I don't think that they actually had, I'm not really sure of this, but I think also the central part was supposed to inflate, and it's not, as you see in the picture.
Okay.
But then I wasn't in the team. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. Does somebody know about that? Or?
Yeah, I seem to recall that they were the little box on the right had lights mm-hmm. in it, and
yeah.
the back membrane in the middle thing was reflective, and so essentially they were taking photos from that box part, as well as shining lights at the membrane, and they were looking at the optical characteristics of the reflector. Okay,
so it was really just a test. Yeah, there was no RF application. Okay,
Alessandra, no.
I'm sorry for distracting you, but I was just curious about that.
Absolutely. This is it's nice someone breaks the ice and starts with a question. So, So that was the STS-77. So I think we were starting on chart 6 at this point. So basically, what we found out just by looking at how we would have scaled it is that this is what we would have done. We would have had the struts, the toroidal ring, and then we would have had a sort of membrane with like little microstrip elements. But we would have, the whole thing would have basically taken almost the whole 3-unit CubeSat. Because if you see number 5 there, is basically how much it would have taken to pack the whole thing. And in addition to that, there is also number 3, which is the gas cylinder we would have needed with that kind of inflation. And so there would have been very, very little space for anything else. And right now, 6 units are very popular, so maybe people would think about rethinking about this idea a little more, although there are other reasons for which we didn't go this route. But at that time, it was also 3 units was pretty much the maximum you were doing with CubeSat. So it didn't completely make sense for us at that point to go with this kind of design. So we came up trying to do a new design. And so we started with the requirements. So if you go on chart number 7, we wanted to have something that was at least 1 meter diameter. There is no specific reason, so there wasn't a specific mission for which we were targeting. But we found 1 meter was a sweet spot for what we wanted to achieve gain-wise in telecommunication. The frequency at that point was S-band, so 2.4. Less than 1 unit and less than 1 kilogram was our target. We ended up being 0.5 units and less than 0.5 kilogram, but where we were designing, that was the requirements, and less than 1 watt for power. And then we wanted something for inflation that was a little different, or that was as simple as possible, occupying as little volume as possible, and also somehow low risk for the main mission. So if we go on chart 8, we didn't want to do pressure vessels, basically, mostly because here there's just an explanation of pressure vessel, you may know more. But the main reason is that CubeSat are basically launched as secondary payload. You need to get a waiver. There are always issues of safety. I was working at that time and on CubeSat trying to test propulsion technologies, and we were having a very hard time on that. And so we were trying to do something that was a little different. So if we go on chart 9, what we ended up thinking about is sublimating powder. In the specific benzoic acid, and sublimating powder, for people who are not very familiar, is basically a chemical substance that, if you give that a certain change of either pressure or temperature, but mostly pressure, it sublimates from a solid to a gas state. we did some analysis and we figured out that with benzoic acid, we just needed a few grams. And that was much, much better than, you know, allocating an entire valve system with the a pressure vessels and all of that. In addition, sublimating powder has also other nice properties one of them, it can act as a makeup gas. So if you basically ran out, if you had punctures or holes and the equilibrium kind of gets alterated, then you can use your makeup powder as an additional inflation system. So there were all these nice properties that we were interested in, and that's why we decided to start working on the sublimating powder. And by the way, that is not a new idea. If you go on chart 10, is basically done before. This is the Echo Balloons of 1964. This was a sort of reflective telecom kind of experiment. These are huge. If you look down there, you're going to see a couple of humans and a car who provide a very interesting factor of scale there on the picture. So this is a huge balloon. In that case, that is on the ground and it was inflated with air, but in space, it was inflated actually with sublimating powder. There are many videos on YouTube. You can go and look at it. It's very, very impressive. So this was something that was actually not completely new, not completely crazy, and that actually someone has done before. So that was somehow motivating into pursuing it into the new form factor of the CubeSat. So what we came up with, and it's basically our design, pretty much with some modification I'm going to go into towards the end of the talk, is what is in chart 11. So in chart 11 basically is the key aspects of the design. It's a very simple balloon in which there is a patch antenna at the focus that is what is indicated in the picture on the right corner as number 3. And then the patch antenna is radiating, and the radiation passes through the transparent mylar section, that is what is indicated with number 2, up to the reflective conductive mylar portion of the antenna, which is number 1. And then the radiation reflects and bounces back in the opposite direction. It stores, I'm going to show you in 0.5, but in definitely less than 1 unit, and inflated with sublimating powder. We did 2 versions, conical and cylindrical. When we started this, we were looking at differences between the two in terms of radiation characteristics as well as the structural mechanics. We ended up having differences, especially in the EM, between the two in the S band, which actually are not as important in the X band. So I'm going to show you the difference, but they are profoundly different at the S band. In fact, if you move to chart 12, these are some results that we ran at that point with the radiation software. So the software used in this case is FECO. You can also use HHSS for this kind of analysis. What it does is that it does MLF-MM, so it's a fast method of movement solution with a finite element modeling to model the dielectric. In other words, what you do is that you build a CAD of both your models, including all the RF features and all the dielectric properties, and then you give it a given voltage, and it basically simulates the radiation characteristic of whatever you are trying to generate. So as you can see, the two diagrams look very different. We have about 16 dBi gain on the conical and a little more dispersed pattern. On the cylindrical, we have a much more directional pattern with about 21 dBi gain. The two of them collapse into almost the same shape at X band, as I'm going to show you at the end. But at that time, when we were doing S-band, they looked profoundly different. And on the RF characteristic, we liked more the cylindrical, although the cylindrical, as I'm going to show you, takes somehow more mass. So what we did is that we developed both in parallel and basically explored both the design at this point. And basically what we did next, if you go on chart 13, is the fabrication of the inflatable. So at that point, I was still at MIT, so we had students helping us. We came up with this model in which you basically design four pedal-shaped pieces that are basically cut out of the mylar, and then you bond them at the edges. We used a specific tape and a specific epoxy to bound the whole structure. And then we also designed a polycarbonate plate, which revealed then to be a very poor choice for what we were doing. But at that time, of course, we didn't know. And that was used to vacuum the antenna, insert the sublimating powder, and insert all of set of connectors and adapters. And I'm going to go in a little bit more details in that in a second. But if we move into chart 14, one of the first thing we did with a couple of these, we had many fabricated at that point, was exactly see if we were accomplishing the volume requirement that I was mentioning. Is there a question? Oh, no. Was just a noise. Okay. We were trying to see if we were able to accomplish that volume requirements I was talking about. So we did a few set of folding. Hello? Okay, just a noise. I think that's maybe my echo, probably, from someone, but I don't know. Anyway, for possible folding, and we tried to basically see how much was the volume. And we had, for the conical, we figured out that actually we can pack it in less than, in around a third of a cube cell. So between 0.32 and 0.28, depending on which kind of folding we use. And alpha a unit is basically what you can do with the cylindrical. This is the antenna only. It doesn't include the benzoic acid, which it's a few grams anyway, but it doesn't also include the canister. So right now, I'm just jumping here a little bit. Right now, that we move to X-band, where we are developing only the conical, and I'm going to explain why we're doing the conical only at X-band in a little while. But right now, including the canister and the patch, we can do the conical in about 0.5 units all together. So that's where we are with the volume. If we go to number 15, we also looked at the preliminary deployment mechanism that student developed still in 2013 when I was at MIT. It is made of an ejector and a base plate, and we have a compression rod, a compression spring on each of the four rods, and then basically the antenna gets packed on top of it. We compress the spring, we put everything into the CubeSat, and we have a nylon wire to hold the door. Now, this is a very preliminary design. There is a lot of problem with the pressure that this design doesn't yet take into account. And one of the work that is planned for next year is actually redesign of the storing canister and of the deployment mechanism on this end. So on chart number 16, we have some of the environmental tests that we did. These were actually the first vacuum test that we did. We are in the process of doing new ones next month. So next month I'll have new pictures and video and results. But these are on the vacuum side. This is all what we have right now. These were done at MIT in the Space Propulsion Laboratory vacuum chamber. You can see on the second picture, if you follow the arrow, that the polycarbonate plate was connected through our swage lock connectors, and we were basically using it to vacuum the antenna and also stick in the sublimating powder. And basically, the third picture, still from the top, is when the antenna was in the chamber. And then if you look to the two bottom-up pictures, those are the both cylindrical and conical shapes as the pressure was dropped and the sublimating powder was starting to work as the inflation gas. They are both, as you see, more than parabolic, so they inflated more than what we expected. And It took us a long time, but we now know why. And this is part of my last chart of my last talk, but that's what we are fixing right now. But it took quite a bit. But basically, it's very simple. It turns out that if you design something to be parabolic and then you put pressure in it, it's going to inflate in something that is more than parabolic. So it took us quite a bit to figure it out, but we are fixing it right now. And so the new version that actually is not version 2, but is version 3, that is being manufactured as we speak, will not have this issue anymore. So this
Alessandra, what maybe you're going to say something about this, but how does the shape of this antenna respond to temperature differences? Maybe that's not important for an interplanetary craft,
no,
but you know, if we go into a shadow, the pressure is going to go down. And so what happens?
It is, and it's actually a big problem, and I was going to say something a little bit at the start, but we didn't test for it, but we didn't formally test for it, but we basically did test, because this was already when we were doing the X-band, so it's going to come up a little bit, but the version 2 of the antenna, we brought it to do the MESA testing in the anechoic chamber, and we inflated it outside, and we brought it inside. And inside, the temperature is much cooler because the equipment need to be kept cool. And we could tell that the antenna was losing its shape and then reaching an equilibrium. So that's definitely a problem, and it's a problem we have already observed. We are the way we think we're going to deal with it is that we are trying to rigidize the antenna in space.
Yeah. Okay, well,
so
that makes sense.
That's the only way we will do it. And that will also partially take care of the micrometeoroid puncturing, for which we also have a residual powder to act as a makeup gas. But that's going to fix only those kind of problems. The residual powder is not going to fix the temperature. So we are now going for something that is going to be UV curing. Arizona State University, which is our academic partner, is doing tests and analysis on that right now. So
okay, thank you.
So if we go to the next chart, I think it's chart 17, this was still the S-band version 1. We did our first test in the anechoic chamber. That was May 2013. It was quite a complicated test to design. Right now we go much faster because we know a lot of this. But at that time, we needed to design this stand that you see over there to have the antenna somehow pointed with respect to the scanner, that is the white thing that you will see where all the cones are on the right. And then we also had to basically use some sort of fishing lines to hold the antenna in a given position. We needed to take accurate measurement to make sure that the antenna, the center of the reflector was aligned with the center of the patch. So it took a little while to figure it out how we could really do the testing. And then we finally did it, and we had some sort of interesting results that weren't what we expected, but we definitely learned a lot from them, and we are applying those to our next design. So if we move on chart 18, the first thing we figured out is that patch that we had, Vid, was not working properly, wasn't giving us the 6 dB. It seems to me, looking at that now that I know more about it, that there was probably mismatch into this antenna or interaction with this polycarbonate plate. As a result, the antenna wasn't gaining 6 dB, but about 4 dB. So that was all our measurements were definitely affected by these aspects. So as a result, what we decided to do was to measure basically everything in delta gain, so not looking at the absolute gain, but basically looking at the difference, at the increase of gain that we get just by adding the reflector with respect to the patch, so we could bypass mostly of the problem, some of the problem of the patch. So what we did in so then we moved forward with that, and we started measuring the conical first, and this is on chart 19, and you can see there for the different frequencies the gain points that we got, and if we look at 2.4 and if you look at the delta gain, which is the red line, There we were expecting about 10 dB because that was the 16 minus 6. So the increment with respect to the patch that was expected was in the order of 10 dB. We got something like 8.9. And we think that the 1.1 dB difference was probably caused by the leakage. These were antennas made by students, and we had a lot of leakage issues. So we thought that was one of the issues. And so then we moved to the cylindrical, which is in chart 20. And that's where the big surprises started, because this one was technically, according to our simulation, supposed to be the one that would have performed better. So since the target for this one was a total peak gain of 21 dB for a given 6 dB patch, we were expecting a differential gain of 21 minus 6, about 15 dB. And instead, as you can see there, we got something very low, like 6.5. So this was very surprising because we thought that the leakage wasn't that bad to cause that drop. So we quite didn't know what to think about this result. One of the guesses that we made was that it may be due to this big polycarbonate plate and how much it was attenuating in front of the CubeSat, the one that I showed in the picture before. We thought it was weird because it wasn't causing the same effect on the conical, but so we wanted to basically test this hypothesis. So if you go on chart 21, what we did is that when we went back to MIT, we basically added this polycarbonate plate in the simulation, as you can see in the card. And then if you go on chart 22, it turns out that really it was messing up with the radiation, because you can see that the peak gain drops from 21 to 12. And so this was compatible with what we were observing in the experimental data. And fascinating enough, that doesn't seem to happen that much with the conical antenna. If you move to chart 23, you'll see that that doesn't quite happen. So this was a sort of validation of at least the correspondence between our measured results and our simulation, as you can see also in chart 24, because if you then compensate for all this plate attenuation, then you get something similar. So if you look at 2.4, these are all in delta gain, so this is the difference with respect to the gain that you would have with the standard patch. We measured an 8.9 sort of increased gain in the conical case, and with the plate correction and the inflation correction, we would have had about 10.2. So we had about 1 dB discrepancy. And with the cylindrical, we actually got really close because we moved from a measure of 15.48 to a 15.5. That is what we were expecting. So we had sort of validation, but we also figured out that there was a long way to go. We needed to get rid of that polycarbonate plate, and we needed to improve the antenna in the manufacturing. There were also some little thermal issues that at that point weren't as evident as they will become in the X-band, but there was a lot to fix. By then, I have moved to JPL. So if we go on page 25, when I joined JPL, one of the things that was discussed with my organization was the possibility to extend this design to the X-band. And this is mostly because there is a lot of development in the interplanetary CubeSat at X-band. This is because at JPL there is a development of a radio that works at X-band. Also, DSN works better at X-band than it does at S-band. So altogether, it seemed a set of good reason to move to the X-band. So we got a little tiny grant, and we started with that basically at the beginning of 2014. And what we did is in trial 26, we start working on the X-band extension. So we basically looked at the new design. The design of the reflector is pretty much unchanged, but we needed to change a few things. One was the patch antenna that, of course, needed to resonate at the different frequencies. So the radiating plate became much smaller, and you see the parameter down there. We also needed to fix the leakage problem. So instead of course, relying on students, we engaged a professional Mylar manufacturer and they are still currently engaged in the process. And they started developing the membranes for us, given a certain design. And then another thing that we did is we got rid of the polycarbonate plate. And we had a different test plate. A couple of words on the test plate before I move. The test plate is what it is, a test plate. So we're not going to have it on board. It's there uniquely because it helps us to connect the different pieces. In other words, the test plate mounts on the stand. It allows us to mount the antenna on it. And it allows us to bolt the patch antenna on the back of it without gluing yet the patch antenna. In the final design, we will glue the two things. But right now, we want to sweep antennas, and we want to change patches, and we want to change membranes. And we want to be able to do this in an agile way without having every time to basically throw away either the patch, either the membrane. So that's why we have the test plate. But this one is new, and you can see that there is a big hole in the middle, and that is what we did to basically allow the patch antenna to radiate through it. It's still not ideal. The ideal case is when we get rid of it completely, but it's much better than what we had before. In this new antenna, as I said, it doesn't basically not have leakage problem, but we observed a quite interesting thermal issue. In fact, if we go on, actually no, on not on next chart. I'm gonna wait on the thermal issue 1 second. Let me go on chart 27. Another thing that we did before we did the test at the MESA was that we did a new simulation of the radiation pattern. And this is the result is visible on chart 27. We have both the conical and the cylindrical at 8.4. The very interesting thing is that the two radiation patterns collapse into basically a very similar one. So in other words, the dielectric property of the Mylar seems to be much less affected at higher frequencies than they were at lower frequencies. So since the gain reached is pretty much the same, that's why we now moved completely to the conical and we are not doing the cylindrical because the cylindrical would take more mass. So that's what happened when I was telling at the beginning that now we are just doing the conical design. So if we go on the next chart, that is chart 28, as I said, we did do some initial X-band tests, for which I do not have the results here because we are still in the process of publishing them. But basically, what happened, this happened at the end of 2014, basically. We had the thermal issues that I was mentioning when I was asked about our thermal impacts. So we had a strong delta temperature that basically affected the antenna, and we didn't have as much leakage as we had with the student membrane, but we still had a little bit, and the test at X-band, it takes much longer time. It's an 8-hour scan, so that didn't fit well, and the old test didn't give us the expected result. So we are basically redoing it, but mostly we are improving the antenna shape and inflation before we move on. So about the end of 2013, after we had this test that didn't achieve the desired gain and we were running on a very, very, very small grant, we won the Center of Innovation Fund, which is a little more money, and we were able to do new things that we desperately needed to. And so one of the things is that we engage a structural engineer, and he has been pretty busy this calendar year, 2015, doing a few things. One is really studying and developing a simulation of the pressure versus shape profile. So he basically has been working with some existing models that we have at JPL to look at which kind of pressure we should really achieve and how that deforms the antenna. And there is where we actually really discovered that something that seems really obvious, but that is not obvious until, I guess, you do it a few times, that if you design an antenna to be parabolic and then you put pressure on it, it's going to inflate in something that is more than parabolic, and then you're going to have some distortion. So right now, the version 3, which is still done by our manufacturer, but is a new design, will be less than parabolic and hopefully will be inflating in the shape that we want. And so the status is that we have released the design to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer is manufacturing the antenna. The antenna should come to us by middle of this month, and then we will do photogrammetry to basically characterize how parabolic the shape is once it's inflated. At the same time, since at the when we test at the MESA, this is not in vacuum, so we need to do a different inflation than what we will do in space. We are developing a little system with the helium and compressed air that will maintain the antenna as inflated as it would be with the sublimating powder while we do the measurement at the MESA. So that's the second development that we are doing. And also we have a student who's working on the electromagnetic simulation and is looking at improving the antenna feed. This is a little bit, it's not as fundamental as the structural work, but it's something that we want to do at a certain point. And I already said we are remanufacturing. And another thing that we are planning towards the middle end of this year is to use one facility that we have here at JPL, that is the Control Dynamic Test Lab, to basically test what's going to happen when the antenna is, when the, if the spacecraft is stumbling, or basically how much the shape of the antenna is sensitive to the spacecraft movement and how the antenna moves and how it gets maybe defocused as the spacecraft rotates or translates. So one other work, as I said, we have a new academic partner that is Arizona State University. They have a brand new vacuum chamber, so they are tackling the other problem. We are mostly dealing at JPL with structure EM, and we are testing in a chamber that is not a vacuum chamber, so we are inflating with air. At Arizona State University, they are inflating with the powder. So they have a vacuum chamber, they have a replica of our antenna, they are doing inflation analysis, and they just the vacuum chamber just came, so they are starting this test, I believe, next week. They also did an extensive review of all the sublimating powders to figure it out which one is best for our case. It turns out that benzoic acid, which was our original baseline, is what we should be going for. So that's very nice. And then they are also looking at reliability. So they did some statistical analysis of likelihood of impact with the micrometeoroids, likelihood of perforation, depth of perforation, rigidization, techniques of rigidization. They reviewed the different techniques, finding out that UV curing is probably the one we want to go for. Actually, the results on that and the results on the powder are in one of the two presentations that they gave at the Interplanetary Small Satellite Conference, and the charts and the video, I believe, are online on these new developments. So this is basically where we are. We are targeting for tests for basically the leakage and photogrammetry test of the new antenna at the end of May. End of June, beginning of July, the radiation testing at the chamber. Vacuum chamber testing will be starting, as I said, middle of May, and the control testing will be done in August. And after that, we will be reapplying for the continuation of the CIF grant. And if everything goes well, we plan to work more on the storage and the deployment. So the last two charts are something a little different, and they look at what's the future in sizes, scalability, and frequency, and comparison with other technology and why we do this. So if we go to chart 29, I always get asked which frequency should I develop this antenna for. So we started with the S-band, and S-band is the most feasible, mostly because the wavelength is longer, it's about 10 centimeters, so we can tolerate wrinkles of 1 centimeter or less. And also the pointing is pretty much achieved, is few degrees, which is achievable with commercially off-the-shelf components for CubeSat those days. Then the second frequency that we worked on is X-band. X-band is still feasible, although wrinkles worries us somehow more, and also the pointing becomes more complex. I don't know if I said this, but I'm on chart 29. And the last frequency is Ka band. I get asked very frequently why I don't do Ka band. I don't think we can at this point, because still we don't have a complete understanding of how we're going to get rid of the wrinkles with the pressure. If we do, and we are able to create a very smooth surface, then we may have a future in Ka band. But at this point, I think it's mostly an S band and X band technology. And another thing that we looked at is how these antennas scale in sizes. And this is part of an article we did for IEEE Aerospace Conference this year, in which we did this calculation. And right now we packed in 0.4 units with 0.4 approximately kilogram of mass for 1 meter. And what I think is a very interesting point of analysis is the 2 meter that will basically take approximately 1.5 unit CubeSat. And I think that's a great result. And that's one of the main reasons for which JPL is funding these developments. In fact, if we look at chart number 30, I wanted to spend like a minute comparing it with some other alternative technologies, because there are a lot of development in the X-band, and what we are doing is basically that there are many concepts that are on the 30 dBi gain, although some of them have less towing efficiency. So what we are doing is, so for example, the reflect array is basically what is going to be on the ESARA mission and on the Mark mission at JPL, foldable panels, and then there is a feed, and then the foldable panels are designed such that they are foldable and they are flat, but they act as a parabolic reflector. This is a very nice technology, and it takes not too much volume, but there are issues to scale this to more panels. And then the other two are the folding rib and the miniaturized reflector. And these are both reflector, and if you look at at the table there, you're going to see that if you compare the diameter, folding rib is 0.5 meter diameter and is stored in 1.5 units. The astromesh is 1 meter diameter and stores in 3 units. And inflatable is 1 meter diameter, but it stores in 0.5 units. So we have 20-to-1 stowing efficiency ratio. And together with the low mass of 0.5 and the scalability, as I was saying, to higher gain, we really believe that if you want to go much higher than 30 dB, and you want to have something that is in the order of 2 meter reflector, there's basically a limited future with the other technologies, and this is the way to go for this kind of big reflector, like 1.5, 2 meter reflector. So we are still developing it at 1 meter because it's a much more manageable size. But we really, once we have done that, our target is going potentially higher than that, once we have solved all the challenges that, of course, I mentioned. So if we go to the last chart, that I think is chart 31, and this is just some conclusion, this is an overview of the project. We have a lot more data, of course, and ideas of what went right or wrong in the S-band, because that's basically a completed project. The X-band is still in the making, so there are still a lot of things that are going on. As I said, the future that is awaiting us is the new manufacturing and the big testing campaign, and then in the future, potentially working on the storage and deployment. And there are a lot of people I have to thank for that are in the next chat. And with that, I would like to thank you. And I think we have like other 10 minutes for questions. If people have some, I'll be happy to take them.
That's great. Thank you very much, Alessandra. This is really cool stuff. And thank you for presenting this. Look, I'm going to take my moderator prerogative and start off with a question for you. You know, this is all being presented in the context of CubeSats and small sats, because, of course, it's very lightweight and it's easy to package. But you talk about the scalability, and it seems like when you design something like this, you've got a lot of assurance that it's actually going to deploy. Should we be looking at this kind of antenna for larger antennas for larger missions? You know, look at it this way. I mean, if Galileo were using an inflatable antenna, and I think it was doing S-band work, it might actually have a high-gain antenna right now, which it doesn't because there was an antenna deployment failure. So what do you say to that? Does this have the potential for much larger antennas for much bigger missions?
It does. I believe, you know, there is always there is a risk factor. The risk factor exists for the inflatable as well as the deployable. Every time I go up for a proposal and I go around asking for money, people, for example, look at the SPS-77 and they tell me that didn't work. And then if you are, I'm friends with the guys that do the deployable, and once they go up for money, they get the Galileo question, as you put it up. And they get answered, you know, the Galileo didn't work. So I think it is a possibility for big spacecraft, but big spacecraft are such an investment of money that it's difficult to sell it as the primary antenna. But what we are thinking is that this antenna takes very little space. So one of the things we have proposed, and we always listed in our proposals, is what if this has a future as a backup antenna?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
You have a Cassini with its own antenna, but or a deployable, or you have, again, a Galileo with a deployable, and that doesn't deploy again. So what if you have another one that takes a shoebox? And you have, you know, it needs to be, the way it's designed right now, it probably would need to be tilted somehow, or it would need to be placed on one of those booms that generally big mission has. So we would need to do some adjustments, but the way we are selling it to big mission is as a backup antenna right now.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, that's a good idea. Thank you very much. Other questions for Alessandra?
Yeah, I have a question about what is the absolute pressure inside of these inflatables? I presume they're very, very low.
Yes, very low, fraction of PSI. So it's very, very low.
And so if you're putting these things on planetary missions, we're talking about Galileo and that sort of stuff, yes. The temperature as you get farther away from the sun is going to be lower, obviously.
Yeah.
The pressure will drop, I think it'll drop differently than just the typical pressure temperature relationship, because it's got the vapor pressure of this powder to deal with. So I'm wondering, at what point does it get to be so low that you're not maintaining the shape of your antenna adequately?
The answer, we don't know the answer to that yet. We hope that we have rigidized it by then.
Okay.
With the UV curing. Because the problem of the temperature is actually also in lower orbit. So, because you're going to have a cycling. So you're actually there. In that case, you're going to cycle and you're going to go through cycles. So at the beginning, we were thinking only that the powder would have acted as a makeup gas and inflated more, which may still happen. We have still a lot to learn on how the sublimating powder reacts to not only changes in pressure, but changes in temperature and combine the changes between temperature and pressure. It's a very interesting problem. And that's why we have in university with a vacuum chamber dedicated to do this kind of experiment, because there's a lot to learn. But we think that the sublimated powder only is not enough, so we want to rigidize it in space. So right now we're trying to figure it out, which of the best of the option of rigidization makes sense for us. It's a very interesting problem because we need to check every time we do a choice there, we need to check how it's going to impact the radiation and the EM properties. So right now I have a set of UV paints and things that I have to check that our students from ISU have provided to me, and I have to check the dielectric property and see whether they're going to affect us or not. But that's where we're going right now.
Okay. I have a second question, which you already just barely touched on, and that has to do with radiation. Obviously, you can use that to your advantage to help you rigidize, cure your material. But I'm just wondering what the long-term stability of your polymer will be in the space radiation environment. And at some point, you might expect your polymers to start breaking down. So there might be a lifetime issue. But it might be a very long lifetime. I have no idea.
Well, no, the problem with the lifetime is definitely a problem. It's a problem also for micrometeorite impacts. That worries me way more than radiation right now. Because, you know, you're going to have a certain frequency of these impacts, and they may damage you much more than radiation, or they may damage you quicker. So, in other words, you may have to worry about them first than radiation.
Okay.
Lifetime is a problem, and that's eventually why we propose it, for example, for Big Mission as a backup antenna, for CubeSat as a high-gain relay antenna to mostly be deployed in location. In other words, if you have a CubeSat that is cruising all the way to Mars, I wouldn't open this thing right after lunch.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Okay, other questions for Alejandro?
Have you considered Ka band?
Yeah, that was in the chart. Actually, I've been asked to consider Ka band. As I said before, I don't think right now we can do Ka band. This is because if you go very high in frequency, the wavelength becomes very little. And then the amount of wrinkles, the dimension of the wrinkles that you can tolerate for a given wavelength becomes more stringent. So right now we don't have yet a very good understanding of how we're going to use the pressure to get rid of the wrinkles. So right now we don't have very, very smooth surfaces right now. So that causes us problem in X band. So in Ka band is totally unfeasible right now. If we improve on that, then yes.
Yeah, if you could get a good enough surface, then it would work.
Yes, it would work. You would need, well, that's another thing, that then the patch antenna, maybe a Ka band may not be the best fit also. So that's another thing. You may need to redesign the feed, but that's another thing that can be done too. So you would probably need to rethink the feed a bit, and but then the rest, the inflatable as a balloon would stay the same if we can get the correct surface accuracy.
Yeah.
From a perspective high frequency operation, I'm just interested in wrinkles. And
yes,
at some point you have to ask yourself, what makes wrinkles and how do you get rid of wrinkles? I mean, is this a matter of the mylar that you're using, the thickness of the mylar? That is with mylar that thick, you will naturally get wrinkles of order a millimeter or so. I mean, what do you need to do? I'm just trying to think how you engineer away wrinkles.
Well, one big reason for the wrinkle is the folding.
You're gonna have to fold it somewhere.
So
you end up with creases in the Mylar. Is that right?
Exactly.
Oh, I see. Okay, now that makes sense. Right now we also have
the problem that our manufacturing is still not, it doesn't have a wrinkle-free manufacturing process. So right now they come to us with some wrinkle, and that shouldn't happen. So, but I think it's a manufacturing problem that once we learn how to make these things, we can get rid of. So let's assume I get a free wrinkle-free antenna out of the manufacturer. Then I still have to fold it.
What about memory materials?
We are looking into that. We didn't look into that yet. It's a very interesting trade because, you know, memory material, we need to always see how much volume then they take. But that's an interesting suggestion, and we are looking into that, and we will look into that a little more.
Other questions for Alessandra? Well, okay. If not, Alessandra, that was really excellent. Thank you so much. Really interesting stuff that's going on. And so let's see. I guess I normally, again, tell people what we're going to do next week. Next week, we'll not have a FISA talk on. And we're hoping the week after that we will. But we've got a whole bunch of them lined up. But things are a little uncertain for the next 2 weeks. So again, thank you to everybody for signing in, and we'll see you again in subsequent weeks. Bye-bye.
Thank you.